supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Seed starting, as I always try to tell people, is not for the timid. If this is your first time gardening, don't try to start your own plants from seed. But if you're an experienced gardener, it is a skill you can learn if you are willing to give the plants the right kind of light. We'll tell you what kind of light that is after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Alexis, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing today?
I am doing well, Alexis. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. It's good to be on the air with you.
It's good to have you. Where are you?
I'm in Wilmington, Delaware.
Excellent, excellent. And what can we do for Alexis in Wilmington?
Well, I am an aspiring urban gardener, and I just upgraded my apartment so that now I have this beautiful big deck that I would love to grow roses and vegetables and the like on. However, the deck faces northwest, and it doesn't get a lot of sunlight. And I know that roses in particular really need sunlight, and so do vegetables. So the question is, I do have some sunlight that is reflected off of my neighboring wall. I share the patio with a neighbor. Mm-hmm. Could I put a mirror up on that neighbor to kind of reflect sunlight back in order to grow vegetables and roses on that garden?
That would be ugly. Was it Alexander the Great who perfected the mirror that actually made incoming ships start to burn, ignited their sails? But before we get to, like, reflected light, I want to drop back a little bit because one of the plants you mentioned is roses. I would not plan to grow perennials in containers. It's one thing to have a perennial with its roots in the soil where it can protect itself, but perennials in pots over the winter are very problematic. In Wilmington, which is in a city in the heat sink of the city, your perennials in pots would survive about 6 winters out of 10, which also means 4 winters out of 10, their roots are going to freeze. You know, if it gets down into the teens for a couple of nights, they're not going to survive in pots, whereby those same plants would survive in the ground. So for now, let's talk about annual plants.
Okay.
Now, how little light do you get during the day on this deck?
Almost none, to be perfectly honest. The sunlight does end up hitting my neighbor's wall, but in terms of like how where I'm getting it right now, it's little to no actual light. Obviously, there's ambient light, and I don't know what it's going to look like in the summer, obviously, because the sun will be higher.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I'm not seeing a lot of light on the deck.
Right, and this is your first year with the deck, so you really are innocent of any knowledge here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the answer is that it becomes really difficult and with some crops actually dangerous to grow them in situations where they don't get enough light. Lettuce and spinach and other greens, even though they require less light than fruiting crops, if they're grown in substandard lighting conditions, they start to develop an excess of nitrogen in their cellular structure. And this is the same nitrates and nitrites that we avoid in processed foods, most famously bacon and lunch meats and stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's just not good. It becomes unnatural. Now, there is a technique that is similar to what you're talking about, but you don't use a mirror. You use white paint or giant white foam core boards.
Oh, okay.
And an old story we did back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine about trying to get more light, you know, like 1 hour more into a garden that got like 5 hours and you wanted to get up to the 6 or 7 that fruiting crops needed. Some people had used these giant pieces of white foam core or painted a wall that the sun hit white. And that would reflect the light without intensifying it the way a mirror could and causing damage. So
gotcha.
It may seem like you had the silliest idea, but there is a corollary in the world of tight urban gardening, and that's to turn that wall white, and it will reflect light The light will also be of a wavelength that the plants can absorb. But I would urge somebody like you to just flood that area with shade-loving flowers. Now, unfortunately, we're probably not going to have any impatiens this coming year. They're begging people not to grow that shade-loving flower because of the blight that hit a lot of the country last season. But begonias are fabulous plants that you could cover your deck with begonias, and they love the shade. So you could have flowering plants out on your deck to make it a nice place where you like to be. And then I would urge you to join a community garden in your area. And actually, because you're in Wilmington, I know of a great resource. There's the Delaware Center for Horticulture, the DCH. And they're in Wilmington. They're very lively, and they're keyed in with the community gardens that are around town. So I suspect somewhere near your home or where you work or go to school or whatever, somewhere convenient to you, there is probably a plot you could get in a community garden that gets plenty of sun. You can grow your own edibles there and grow shade-loving flowers at home.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Mike.
My pleasure. It's a great question. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
Well, thank you for being had. Joe, where are you?
We're in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Beautiful little area just outside of Philadelphia.
Yep. Love living there.
What can we do for Joe in Jenkintown?
Well, my wife and I have a bit of an argument going back and forth. We have a cherry laurel that is about 10, 12 feet tall and has fallen over with the recent storms. The roots are pretty much still buried, but it's laying fairly far down, and we hope to be able to save it. Now, the ground's still pretty frozen at this point. She thinks we should try and straighten it out at this point. I'm thinking leave it until the ground gets soft enough. I want to try and maybe get underneath it a bit, open it up, and see if I can, you know, as we straighten it, drop it down a little bit. What do you think?
These cherry laurels are excellent screening trees, or I shouldn't call them trees, screening plants. They really make a nice, dense hedge, and they have a beautiful appearance. But typically, when a plant falls out of the ground and lays on its side, you can see the root system. In your case, you can't see the root system, you're saying.
So when I say it's laying down, because it's so bushy, I think it hasn't quite pulled everything out of the ground.
But you don't see a big clod of dirt that's out of place?
A little bit. There's a little bit of a mound.
Okay. We're going to act like the roots are out of the ground. So what I want you to do is get a load of topsoil or compost or anything other than wood or bark mulch. And I want you to mound it over the area where the roots are.
Okay.
And should the weather turn dry over the winter, I actually want you to water that mound.
Okay.
And make sure no roots are exposed.
Right.
So we're doing a variation on a technique called healing in. We're just going to make sure the roots are covered with dirt, especially this time of year. The plant doesn't care if it's growing sideways. It doesn't want its roots exposed to the desiccating winds of winter. So you really want to mound soil over top of that potential root system. If we go a week without rain, and don't be shy about putting some water on top of that. And then watch for the other plants to green up. And hopefully you're going to see some new green growth on that. And then what I want you to do is get some help and try to figure out something soft that you can slide underneath of it. And then have people pull back on, you know, like a clothesline, but hopefully softer than that. Nothing that's going to bite into the plant, but something that's going to get underneath. And have a bunch of guys. Now, I don't care how light or heavy it is, but you want people pulling in all directions very gently. And then you can have somebody, once you get it up slightly, then you can get somebody in the middle pressing against it with something that's going to diffuse the force, too, like big pieces of cardboard. Don't be pushing it with bare hands or even gloved hands. Try to distribute the force evenly. And then if you can get it upright, I would recommend highly against trying to stake it or do anything like that, if it doesn't feel like it's really holding on, then what you can do is knock a couple stakes into the ground behind it and then literally run a velvet rope, if you know what I mean. Very soft that's just going to provide enough support to keep it from falling forward. Nothing that bites into it, nothing hard. And if all seems well, but it's still a little bit unstable, go to a good garden center or look online and get some bacteria that are good for enhanced root growth. There are various naturally occurring soil bacterias that are very good at enhancing root growth. What you would do, it would come in a powder form, you would sprinkle it around the plant, and then you would cover that with compost to help it become bioactivated. That would help the plant grow new roots to help stabilize it in the soil.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your advice, Mike.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners that seed starting time is fast approaching, or already here for those of you who don't know from ice dams on your roof. Timing is easy. Start your seeds about 8 weeks before you can reasonably expect to plant those kind of plants outside. That's early in the season for cool weather crops like lettuce and spinach, and after all risk of frost is gone with summer lovers like tomatoes and peppers. But don't go searching for your last average frost date just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to start those seeds off to a good and healthy life. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, the big mistake most people make when they start their seeds the first time is underestimating the amount of light young plants need. You don't want to put out tomatoes that are tall and skinny. You want them short and stocky and headed for a healthy life. We'll tell you how light will help you achieve that after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tony, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing well, Tony. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm in the perennially wintertime capital of Philadelphia, East Mount Airy.
Okay.
All right. If you want snow, come here. We always get.
So you're just in one of those little microclimates, huh?
Yes, yes.
What can we do for Tony in snowy Mount Airy?
You can help my husband, Tom. He gets me every year a really lovely gardenia plant around Easter time because he knows I love them. And then, of course, it never blooms again. So this time he's decided he's going to try to make it bloom. And he's growing it in a northwest window, and it's beautiful. It's green. It doesn't show any sign of getting another, you know, white gardenia on there, but it's got little buggy holes on the leaves.
Inside?
Inside.
That's unusual. First of all, you're doing very well.
Okay.
Gardenias are one of the most finicky plants to grow indoors.
My mother used to say they get jealous of other plants, and you had to be really careful with them. She knew how to do them. I didn't.
It takes a really green thumb to be very successful with an indoor gardenia. And, of course, a lot of people take them out in the summertime.
Yes.
And the plants really enjoy that. And that's a time when, you know, various beetles or little caterpillars or whatever might chew a couple of holes in the leaves. But it's very unusual that you would have a leaf-chewing pest indoors in the wintertime. I can't imagine, I mean, fungus.
Maybe it came in with the plant.
Are new holes appearing? How big are the holes? How big is the plant?
They're real tiny. The plant is about 12 inches tall, and it's really beautiful. It blooms outward. I mean, it's growing outward, you know, and it looks real shiny.
And
it keeps getting new little leaves shoots on the in the inside.
That's a good sign. And
yeah.
are the holes in the old leaves or the new leaves?
It varies.
Okay.
You know, they're in old and new.
But it's not obviously not damaging the health of the plant.
It doesn't seem to be, no.
One thing
he was concerned that it wouldn't bloom, and he wondered if you could tell him what he could use to, you know, force it to bloom maybe.
Okay, that's different. One thing that people fail to realize is a little bit of nibbling is actually very good for most plants. It stimulates the growth, and it stimulates the plant to bloom. Yeah, there are all these great studies that were done years ago where they killed every insect in a field to make sure that nothing was nibbling on the crop. And in other fields, they managed it just down to a normal amount where, you know, you would see holes in the leaves, but, you know, there was not huge damage being done, and they got bigger yields from the fields that had some insect damage. It only makes sense. When an insect is nibbling, it sends a signal to the plant to send out its internal defenses, grow faster, perhaps even produce a flower.
Right. Now, again, antibodies.
Right. Now, I presume you keep the soil nice and moist without overwatering it.
Right.
And you do not let water collect in the saucer underneath, right?
No.
Okay. Have you fed it anything?
No.
You can actually go and get a nice organic plant food for houseplants, for flowering houseplants.
Okay.
I know Gardens Alive sells them specifically branded that way, but so do a lot of products at retail. But you'll have to go to a hip garden center, not to a big box store.
We have Primix right near me.
You know what? They probably have worm castings on the shelf right now. What I would do if I were you is I would go and get a nice little cute bag of worm castings. They don't have any smell or anything. They look like beautiful, rich soil. And put an inch of that on top of the pot, and then every time you water it, the plant will get a little gentle feeding. And if you really want to do something to try to improve the bloom, just like a teaspoon of rock phosphate, which is a natural, it's a mined substance. It's mined from phosphate deposits.
I heard you tell someone that last week.
It's super powerful.
Yeah.
A little bit goes a long way. You only use it like once every 3 years, so you want to buy the smallest bag you can. But during the growing season, you can also spread like a tablespoon to like a quarter cup around your bigger plants outside, like rhododendrons and azaleas.
Oh, I have them. That'll be great.
And just do that once, though, and have a very light hand. A little bit goes a long way, and it persists so long in the soil, you only have to add it every 3 to 5 years. But it is the best natural bloom booster you can try. And if you don't do it already, mist the plant first thing in the morning. Spray some just plain water on its leaves. It loves it.
Oh, okay.
It sounds like the plant is absolutely healthy. You're six steps ahead of most people with indoor gardenias.
Great. I'm so glad. Maybe I'll get one this year.
All right.
A brand new one, I guess.
Oh. Well, good luck, Tony.
Thank you, and I'll see you at the flower show, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The Philadelphia Flower Show, the first week in March. I'll be there as much as I can.
Okay. Bye, Mike. Thank you.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Rebecca, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm excited.
Oh, excellent. And where is Rebecca excited?
I'm excited in Vandalia, Ohio.
And where is that? Is that in the Dayton area?
Yeah, we're about 10 minutes north of Dayton.
All right. What can we do for Rebecca in Vandalia?
Yes. I have a question about how to deter stray cats from pooping in flower beds.
That is a common question. And one thing I want to start out by saying, no matter what we do here, I want you to promise me you're going to wear gloves whenever you work in that soil.
Definitely now, yes.
Because, you know, this is what cats do. You know, they deliberately seek out loose soil, and then they bury the evidence, you know, cover the feces to protect the species so that other predators or their prey don't realize that cats are nearby. They try to cover it. It's a very natural thing for them to do, but especially cats that are outdoors, the likelihood of parasites being transmitted to the soil is high. And that's less of a danger in, like, let's say you're growing tomatoes there. It's unlikely the parasites would be inside the tomatoes. But the danger is in working the soil. You know, just the tiniest little cut will get it into your skin. And not only that, but don't touch your face, which is always a good gardening mantra. But when you're out there, you know, same thing. If you're working with poison ivy, if you're cutting up hot peppers, if you're working in soil that could have cat poopy in it, don't touch your face. Don't touch your face. That's your mantra. Now, there are several things you can do. One of the oldest tricks, if you want to go out and get a roll of chicken wire, very cheap. You know what chicken wire is, right?
I've actually tried the chicken wire before.
Yeah.
I did it when I planted bulbs originally, and we had chipmunks really bad. I embedded chicken wire into the soil to keep them from digging up the bulbs to eat them. And it worked on the chipmunks, but it didn't work so much on the cats. They just kind of laid their presence on top of it.
That's unusual. Those are not healthy cats then.
Yeah, they're we used to have wood mulch, and once I got rid of all the wood mulch, we went to leaf compost, and we started using that as mulch. Unfortunately, because it also improved my soil, made it nice and, you know, loose, it just, like, attracted the minrows, it seems. And
now, see, I have used the chicken wire thing in my own garden, and yes, sometimes squirrels will wear little construction helmets and put on little leather gloves and pull it up from a corner. But I've never had a cat ignore it, because generally a healthy cat will not defecate where it can't scratch up the soil. And you can imagine what it's like to try to scratch up soil that's covered by chicken wire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought it would work, too. And for some reason, there's, I think, two cats in particular that just sort of go wherever, and they definitely don't cover.
Okay, so we're going to move right up the line. We're going to go for a motion-activated sprinkler.
Okay.
You buy it once, you hook it up to your hose, it's got a 9-volt battery in the head, you point it at the area you wish to protect, you turn your hose on full blast, and nothing happens until something walks in front of it and breaks the beam. Then it turns towards them and hits them with a couple cups of cold water. The cats levitate. They turn into Warner Brothers cartoon characters. They go straight up in the air, and then their wheels start spinning. And then they're out of there. It's the perfect solution because it doesn't harm them in the least, but it gives them a lesson. And it also works on groundhogs, deer, effective against squirrels, neighborhood dogs, Canada geese. It's remarkably effective at keeping Canada geese off of a lawn. And unlike things that you would spray in the hope that they would keep the cats away, you don't have to keep buying it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
That's once and done, and you'll find it to be remarkably effective. I literally could not garden without my motion-activated sprinkler. I couldn't protect my wife's peaches from squirrels and raccoons without motion-activated sprinklers. They're a real godsend. Like I said, you buy them once and you're done. If you want, also go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org and go to the section at the top that says Garden Answers A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
And under the letter C and under the letter P is an article called Keeping Pets Out of the Garden. And there's all sorts of other ideas in there about using chopsticks and red pepper shake and all these other things. But the motion-activated sprinkler is the way to go. And it's tons of fun. You know, make a video and put it up on YouTube.
Okay. All right. Sounds great.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Alan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Alan, how are you, sir?
Excellent.
And where is Alan Excellent?
I'm in Overbrook Farms in Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. What can we do you for?
Mike, I have a kind of a large lot and a big metal back fence, which was covered with what I think was Japanese honeysuckle.
Did it smell delicious on a warm summer night?
Yeah. For about a week in the summer, it had that very pungent, sweet smell. And it grows like crazy. Seems like a foot overnight.
Yes. A Japanese honeysuckle is one of the most despised, invasive, and at the same time beloved plants in all of horticulture. There is no scent like that. I can't think of a single other plant that produces so much nectar that you can literally drink it out of the flower cups at the right time. But it does grow like a weed, and it has become an invasive pest in this country.
Yeah, I mean, it really wraps around every tree or plant that's near it, and it also spreads through the lawn along the edges of the lot with these thick vines and deep rhizome roots that are impossible to get out.
One of the ways to control a plant like this is to spend two entire seasons just cutting the vines back. Don't let that big biomass on your fence exist anymore. Just go down to the base of the fence with a good pair of pruners or loppers and just cut it off, sever it where it comes up out of the ground, and keep doing that. Watch it as it comes up in your lawn. Do the same thing. Cut it off. And then as we get towards the end of summer, if you wish, you can actually go after any sprouts that are still coming up in your lawn with a high-strength vinegar or this new herbicide that's made with iron, which is very useful when something's in a lawn because the lawn tends to like the iron, but the iron kills other plants. And then wait like a couple of weeks, and if you did damage to a section of the lawn, the first week of September is the ideal time to overseed a lawn. But if you keep cutting back the plants, allowing them to grow a stem, a stalk, but not allowing them to set good leaves for long, you'll exhaust the root system.
Okay.
Otherwise, we're talking backhoe, you know.
Now, when I dig them out with a dandelion fork, am I just wasting my time?
No. I mean, especially, do you soak the soil first?
Not usually. I mean, I try and do it after there's been a rain.
That's
know,
good.
They come up easier.
Exactly. The wetter the soil, the more of the root you will get up. But for instance, if you could do that, dedicate yourself to doing that and backing it completely out of the lawn, then you could install deep edging or rhizome barrier around the edge of your lawn, and you could at least keep it out of that area. And of course, never cut your lawn below 3 inches.
Right.
So that your lawn can outcompete it, and never feed your lawn in the summertime unless it's zoysia grass.
Right. It seems to be in the areas where there's the lawn's a little thin because of the shade and see clumps coming up.
If that's true, in this, you might want to till that area up in mid-August. Really try to get out as much of the honeysuckle as you can. Cover it over with compost and reseed that area like the last week of August, first week in September. That's when the honeysuckle is at the weakest. Your lawn fescue is going to grow at the strongest. The lawn can actually outcompete this weed if it's kept healthy enough.
Okay, I'll give it a try. It seems to be the plant equivalent of rabbits, but we'll give it a shot.
Well, it is. It is one of the three top invasive plants known. But again, if you and if your lawn is in the shade, get a ruler. You want your lawn to be 3.5 inches high in the shade after you're done cutting it. If you do that, it can develop the kind of root system the underground can take this on. Underground, it's an Ali Frazier fight. But you got to give your lawn what it needs. That's a spring feeding, a fall feeding, no summer feeding, a good high cut, and my money's on the lawn.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mike.
All right. Good luck, man.
Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn listeners that my springtime tour continues. I'll appear at the Upper Dublin Public Library at 7 p.m. this coming Monday, February 18th. At the Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA, Friday through Sunday, February 22nd through the 24th. At the Wilmington Home Show at the Chase Center on the waterfront, Saturday and Sunday, March 2nd and 3rd. And at the famed Philadelphia Flower Show on Wednesday, March 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to start your own plants using the right kind of light. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. We told you a couple weeks ago about the right mix for starting seeds. Now we're going to tell you about the other essential ingredient, bright light. And no, your sunny south-facing windowsill is not bright light. It's death on a stick. We'll tell you why after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Clay, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing just fine in central Oklahoma today. And yourself?
All right. Very good. Very good. Well, it's a little bit chillier here, I would expect, but We get decent rain, Clay. I hate to rub that in, you know.
Well, it's been rough on that account for us here the past couple of years.
What can we do for Clay in Oklahoma?
Well, I have a pair of home brewing related questions for you. One is about growing hops. I'm wondering, I've got them in pots, as they're supposed to be kind of invasive. I've cut them back. Last year was the first year that I had them. And I don't know if I should take them out of the pots and replenish the soil, or if their root system from the rhizomes would be disturbed if I did that.
They really should be planted in the ground, man. And I'm not sure that hops are invasive. They can be difficult to grow in humid climates. I've not heard of hop growing in Oklahoma. I'm pretty sure they need a winter chill of some kind, but you get a decent one. No, I wouldn't try to grow them in pots. They're going to get root bound, or it should you get a cold winter, which I know you tend not to get very many freezing days, but they would die in the pots if you drop down into the teens.
Okay. We get drops down in the teens, but it's usually just overnight, and you know, by midday or so, we're well into the mid-30s.
It's risky. Perennial plants really need to have their roots in the ground, unless you're like in some paradise like San Diego or southern Florida.
Okay, so do you recommend just basically pulling all the soil from the pot out and putting them in a big oversized hole?
Yeah, planting them in the ground. You want them, they need good airflow. They're very vulnerable to humidity, which won't be a problem in central Oklahoma. Now, will it, Clay?
No, not so much.
So you're going to have to keep them watered in their second and third year. As they get older, they're going to grow very tall. So they,
yes, I've heard up to 18 to 20 feet a year.
Yeah, they need
this year, since it was the first, I didn't trim them back at all, and they got super bushy and still probably 6 or so feet long just in the couple months growing season that they had.
Yeah, you'll want to trellis them. They do especially well on an arbor type situation, you know, where you trellis them up like 6 feet, and then there's like an open platform up there where they can trail across, and then the hop flowers can like hang down, and you can have an alley of soothing hops all around you.
Well, right.
Yeah, but I'd get them in the ground and start harvesting rainwater. Seriously, start preparing to be ready to, because they do grow so much. They're going to need a lot of water, and keep a good mulch on the surface of the soil.
Good deal. And then my other question related to home brewing would be, what to do with my spent grains? Is it okay to compost those? And as such, should I treat them as green or as brown material?
You know, I should know this, and I'm going to be honest and say that I don't. I do know that spent grains from brewery waste are used in compost. And I would think, I'm just going to guess, because they're grains, that they're more nitrogen than they are carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you guys have had a hard time. How's your supply of deciduous leaves? Do you have enough browns to mix to make good compost?
Actually, having enough browns has been kind of a challenge for me.
Yeah.
We've got leaves that I harvest year-round. I just leave them in a pile and kind of add them on as I do a lasagna method over the winter, and just let that sit, and then I start turning it in the spring. And it usually does okay, but I do worry in general about my compost being a little on the hot side.
Well, a hot compost is good.
I'm sorry. I mean, hot as in real high in nitrogen.
Oh, yeah. Then it just gets slimy and messy. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
It would help to chop up your browns. And remember that any green material that has turned brown is now a dry brown. Now, you don't want to use sawdust or wood shavings. They're just too carbon rich. But one thing that people would neglect that I think would be abundant in your area would be old corn stalks from the previous season. Once they've turned brown, they're very similar to fall leaves. I would get a chipper shredder, run the corn stalks through it, mix up your brewery waste with that. I think you'd get some real cooking compost out of that combination.
Well, excellent, Mike. Thank you again so much for taking my call. You've been a big help.
Thank you for making it, and good luck. I'm sending mental images of rain to you guys this summer.
All right. We certainly appreciate it.
All right. Take care, man. 1-888-346-9499. Lola, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Lola. Where are you?
I'm in Philadelphia.
Where?
I'm in East Oak Lane section of Philadelphia.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Lola in East Oak Lane?
Well, I have a bell pepper plant that I purchased about 2 summers ago.
Right.
And it's still alive and producing peppers.
Indoors.
Indoors. Yeah, I brought it out. It was outside on the patio when I first bought it, and then I brought it in when the weather turned cooler, and I had it out last summer also, so it's in the house now.
Right.
And I have two questions. Well, first of all, I didn't know that bell pepper plants grew like that. I thought they were annuals, and they just produced and died. And then the other thing is, I'm wondering if those peppers are safe to eat. I have been nibbling on them, but I've been a little afraid. Are they still safe to eat after all of these seasons?
They are perfectly safe to eat.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
I perennialize my peppers as well.
Oh, okay.
Should you ever vacation down in especially New Mexico, you will see habanero trees that are 10, 15, 20 years old. That have, and you've noticed this, your pepper plant, as it's gotten older, no longer has a green stem, right? It's
right.
Nice and woody, like a little tree or a shrub.
Yes, right.
We call peppers annuals the same way we call bedding plants, like impatiens and annual begonias, annuals. Mm-hmm. But in truth, they are not. They are frost-sensitive perennials that typically do die when the weather gets cold, but unlike a true annual, like a tomato plant, which you cannot carry for years and years, they do have like a genetic time bomb. At the end of a season, they're done. But peppers can live for 10 or 20, 30 years.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Same with the shade-loving flowers, impatiens and begonias. These bedding plants and peppers are perennial in their native environment. You know, down in the tropics where peppers come from, it's not unusual to see these ancient plants. And, quote, New Guinea impatiens. If you go to New Guinea, you'll see impatiens that are many, many years old. The one thing with peppers that I always advise people is wash them down really good before you bring them inside at the end of the summer.
Yes.
Because aphids do like to hitchhike on them.
Yes, I did do that.
Well, then you're perfect.
All right.
And the fact that obviously they're getting a lot of sun inside if they're continuing to bloom and
good
produce
sun.
Fruit.
Now, one thing, I get a lot of little blooms, and some of the blooms, they just kind of dry up and drop off.
Right.
But so I don't get as many as I did when I first bought the plant. But I am still, I'll get two or three every now and then. And they're smaller, too. They only get to be about maybe an inch and a half in diameter now.
And the ones in the summer, they get bigger?
Yeah, and the bigger, yes.
And do you keep it in the pot over the summer?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Next season, when you put it outside for the spring, you might want to plant it up into a bigger pot.
Oh, yeah.
That'll allow it to grow bigger peppers. Mm-hmm. But everything you're talking about is absolutely normal. But indoors, keep it away from cold air and warm air. Keep it away from any kind of draft. Make sure it gets as much sun as possible.
Yeah.
Turn it frequently so that every side gets sun. And only water when the pot feels light so that you don't accidentally waterlog the plant. Never let any water collect in the saucer underneath.
Okay. Well, all right then. I'm glad to get that information. I enjoy your show very much.
And I enjoy hearing about peppers growing in the winter. It makes me happy.
Oh, okay.
Take care, Lola.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Seed starting. Let there be modern light. Alexis Landis back from maternity leave producing You Bet Your Garden. Read this week's question, s'il vous plaît.
Absolutely. Well, we heard from a listener who has some advice for you. Sarah from Ridgefield, Connecticut writes, "Dear Mike, I enjoy your show, but please stop giving outdated advice to your listeners about using 40-watt fluorescent lamps to start seeds. You are correct to recommend regular shop lights instead of those lavender grow lights. But the technology has changed over the years, and the old-style lamps you recommend are no longer even used commercially. They have been replaced by 32-watt T8 fluorescents, which give off almost the same lumens as the old 40-watt T12s and have much better color rendering properties. Best regards.
And we should mention here that this isn't just Sarah from Ridgefield, Connecticut. This is Sarah, who's a lighting designer, Schreger Lighting Design in Ridgefield, Connecticut. So, oh boy, I'm in trouble. And you know what? I have probably been guilty of using imprecise language with at least one caller per show over the past 14 years. But my mental intention is always to try to get across an important point. And with seed starting and lights, it's generally the, quote, sunny windowsill is actually Latin for sorry about your pitiful looking plants. And that success with seed starting requires either a greenhouse or artificial light. When it comes to artificial light, at least I always recommend 4-foot long fluorescent tubes. But my bad, Sarah is right. I probably still do say, quote, 40-watt tubes. For the same reason that I call our refrigerator an icebox, refer to aluminum foil as tin foil, and say dial the phone, even though it's been decades since I've even seen a phone with a rotary dial. Hey, remember what a pain they were when somebody had a bunch of nines in their phone number? It took forever to call them. But those are the things I grew up with, and old habits die hard, especially for the Irish, and especially for Irish from Philadelphia who have perfected their thickness into an art form. Sarah is 100% correct. And in fact, the 40-watt fluorescent tubes I talk about are actually the same T8 32 watts that she uses and recommends. I upgraded to those newer, thinner, lower mercury, more energy-efficient T8-style lights when they first came out. And who knows, in a couple of decades, I may even refer to them correctly. But don't count on it. Anyway, the timing of this is excellent, as a few weeks ago we discussed the perfect, quote, medium, that's a soil-free mix, for starting seeds. So this is a great opportunity to discuss the young plant's need for light once they are started. Now, in brief, seeds should be sown in water-saturated, soil-free mix, covered with a little bit more mix, and then be covered with plastic wrap and kept warm but not hot. If you're going to do this every year, invest in a heating mat that keeps things at a constant 70 to 75 degrees. That gets the plants up fast. Otherwise, just sit the containers out in the open in a warm room and clap if you believe in fairies. Check them every day and keep the mix moist. When you see the very first sprouts appear, remove the plastic and stop with the bottom heat. Don't wait for all the seeds to sprout. Ditch the heat and plastic at the very first sign of the very first sprout, and then get them into bright light, which does not mean your so-called sunny windowsill. Very few, if any, windows, even south-facing ones, deliver light that's bright enough to help starts grow up short and stocky like those store-bought plants. Tall, thin seedlings are a sure sign of light deprivation. A greenhouse that stays warm at night and vents excess heat automatically during the day will capture enough light to be ideal for strong growth. But most home gardeners don't have a greenhouse, thus their need for artificial light. Now, someday soon, that light will almost certainly be delivered by super-efficient LEDs. I'm testing a mini-garden setup right now that uses LEDs. But until that confluence of affordability and super-efficient bright light arrives, fluorescents are currently the best way to deliver good amounts of light without eating up lots of energy. I start my plants under both two-tube fixtures and four-tube fixtures, all of which take four-foot-long tubes. The four-foot tube fixtures generate so much intense light over such a wider area that I can relax and keep the tops of those plants a few inches away from the lights. But I have to keep the plants much closer when I use my two-tube shop light-style fixtures. The tops of those plants are never more than an inch away from the tubes. You have to keep the plants close as fluorescent light intensity drops dramatically as you get a few inches away. But you can keep them close. Fluorescent light is cool and it's not going to burn the plants. Now, over the years, I've experimented with keeping some of the lights on 24/7 and giving other plants 8 hours of darkness every night via timers. After years of this experimentation, I now recommend going 24/7 if you're using a two-tube fixture, especially if you're cowardly about distance, and compact systems that use two-foot-long tubes, and keep those plants up tight to those shorter tubes. But if you have a four-tube setup, you can certainly turn the lights off at night. Or if you want to be really clever, and you're good at paying attention, and you're not too clumsy, you could even rotate two trays of starts under a single four-tube setup, moving each flat out of or back under those lights every 12 hours. Well, that sure was some useful information about starting seeds with bright light now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it with links to much more information about seed starting success at your leisure. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to shut my light if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired report, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line or we won't get the email. And check voice to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Watch the video of my recent TEDx talk. Listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook, where we post new content every day. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al. Hang the phone up, thanks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminate. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, was brightly started. Ace production assistant sap-sucking Brett Rader is the hero of the WHYY Winter Pledge Drive. Brett Smash! Esteemed editor Al Banks collected the coffee grounds from that pledge drive so they can be well used. I'm nitrogen-rich Mike McGrath, and I'll see to it that the grounds of Banks are put to good use. Ha! Begonia's the size of a child! Yes! Yes! Ha! And I'll see you next week. Thinking about being a real American gardener and growing the three sisters? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to pair up corns, beans, and squash in a Native American way. Plus your fabulous phone calls.